Hey there, it's your host, Shannon Ballard. Southern Mysteries is an independent podcast made possible by the support of patrons who help me continue to share stories like you'll hear today. I appreciate all of my patrons, including our newest members, Samantha Lauderdale from Pikeville, North Carolina, Karen Zador from St. Augustine, Florida, David Holsenbach from Bunky, Louisiana, Vanessa Dunning from White Plains, Kentucky, and Renee Dixon, who is listening and supporting from a mysterious location. When you join them in supporting the show on Patreon, you can hear ad-free episodes and the show archive of the first three seasons. You can also join at a level where you have access to lots of bonus content, like the archives of patron-exclusive podcasts and the new patron-exclusive monthly podcast, Audacious, Tales of Scandalous and Shocking Crimes in American History. There are two tiers, two options to join in on Patreon, and it's easy to opt in and out. You can check it out for yourself, join, and start listening to episodes you haven't heard today at patreon.com/southernmysteries. The New Orleans trunk murders are a long-forgotten, dark chapter in the city's history. The gruesome discovery of two dismembered bodies in the French Quarter in October 1927 was one of the most violent crimes reported in the city in the 1920s. Welcome to Southern Mysteries, exploring history and mysteries of the American South. I'm your host, Shannon Ballard. This is the story of the New Orleans trunk murders. The French Quarter is one of the most popular half-square miles in the world. It's been a must experience for tourists since it was dubbed Vieux Carré, a term meaning old square in French. The quarter is situated on the banks of the Mississippi River. In the late 18th century, the iconic St. Louis Cathedral was erected in Jackson Square. Bourbon Street was a thriving residential street. But by the late 1850s, the French Quarter began a decades-long decline as the culture, cuisine, and shopping in the quarter began to shift to other areas of New Orleans. Large houses were no longer occupied by single families in the quarter. They were turned into rooming houses. Some even became warehouses. Railroad tracks and industrial buildings were constructed near the riverfront in the 1860s, which led many wealthy residents in the quarter to relocate to more peaceful residential areas of the city. For the working class of New Orleans, the decreasing property values of the French Quarter meant lower, more affordable rent. By the 1920s, it had become racially and ethnically diverse and was heavily populated by first and second generation Sicilians. To city boosters, the French Quarter had become what they called an embarrassing slum, full of derelict buildings that deserved demolition. This demand for demolition of the quarter would lead to a French Quarter renaissance of the early 1920s. After World War I, artists, writers, musicians, and journalists began to move to New Orleans and chose to settle in the French Quarter. The cheap rent around Jackson Square, along with the vibrant street life and charm of New Orleans, attracted new attention. William Faulkner, Sherwood Anderson, Tennessee Williams, and Truman Capote were among just a few of the writers attracted to the French Quarter. By 1922, the thriving art scene and historic preservation had drawn tourists and new business back to the quarter. With the area in demand again for tourists, rent and real estate prices began to increase, which meant fewer of the dreamers who had helped revitalize the quarter wanted to live there anymore. Either they viewed it as being too commercial and lacking the artistic appeal that drew them there, or they were priced out of the place they loved. They began to move to other areas of the city that were less commercialized, and the bohemian dream of the French Quarter began to fade. Another side effect of the growth of the French Quarter was an increase in crime. Prohibition, gambling, drugs, and prostitution were associated with organized crime in the city, but the public attitude and tolerance for all of this didn't lead to an effective syndicate taking hold of New Orleans until the 1940s. The crime that seemed to make everyone in the Crescent City stop in their tracks, actually shocked them, was a grisly scene discovered on the second floor of a French Quarter home. It had been renovated into apartments in the decades before the bloodbath of 1927. On October 27th of that year, a young housekeeper named Nettie Compass entered the apartment to clean the home for the tenants, brothers Henry and Joseph Moiti, and their respective wives, sisters Teresa and Leonidae. The moment Nettie opened the door, she saw a pool of blood at her feet. Fear overtook her, and she began screaming as she ran downstairs, where she was met by concerned neighbors. Two insurance salesmen, who happened to be walking by and heard the commotion, inquired as to what happened. When Nettie told them what she found in the apartment, one of them immediately called in a tip to a local reporter, George Healy. Healy described what he saw in his 1976 memoir, writing, "We found red stains on the floor and saw a large trunk in a bedroom, partially opened. When I pulled up the trunk lid, a woman's body, arms and legs, severed from the torso, was exposed." Healy went to a neighboring apartment to call a second reporter to help him protect his story, cover the scene, and later suggested they should alert the coroner. The coroner arrived with Healy's colleague, Gwen. She noticed several objects on a bed, and as she reached for them, realized it was four fingers that had been cut from a woman's hand. Shocked, Gwen placed the fingers back on the bed and moved to the second bedroom, where she found another trunk. Inside was the dismembered body of a second woman. A bloody cane knife was resting on the torso. A cane knife is a large, hand-wielding cutting tool used primarily in the harvesting of sugarcane. On average, the blade is more than 12 inches long and extremely sharp. When police arrived on scene, they surveyed the two small travel trunks packed with butchered corpses. The bathroom was covered in blood, as was a mattress that was blood-soaked. Clothing that they believed had been tossed from the trunks to make room for each woman's remains was strewn around the apartment. The officers and the reporters found it hard to take in. For many of them, it was the first time they had come across a scene this bloody and horrific. Dr. George Rowling, the Orleans Parish coroner, examined the remains and found both women had been bludgeoned first with a lead billy club. Their killer then decapitated them with the cane knife and amputated their arms and legs. The Times-Picayune covered every detail of this case, noting Dr. Rowling determined that the killer was skilled with a knife. This person knew not to try to cut through the bone, but to cut through the joint. Dr. Rowling also noted he had recovered a gold wedding band that was buried deep in the back of one of the victims, Teresa Moiti. Her sister, Leonidae, was the second victim. As police searched the Moiti apartment, they came across a handwritten manuscript in a cabinet in Leonidae's bedroom. Leonidae tried to publish the autobiographical story in a women's magazine, but the story and rejection slip she received was found covered in blood at the scene. Part of the Times-Picayune coverage of the murders of Teresa and Leonidae included publishing portions of Leonidae's tale of a woman who lived in poverty, but was hoping to find joy and a fresh start in her hometown with a new husband and child after a failed marriage. The story ended with a warning. "Now to you readers, young girls especially, please think ahead of you and do not make the mistake I've made, because it does not always turn out the right way. You can still be disappointed. So I warn others not to take the same risk." Leonidae's story was believed to have been written before she and her sister Teresa moved to New Orleans. The sisters were born in New Iberia, but moved to New Orleans after they married brothers Henry and Joseph Moiti. The couples lived with their five children in the 1,000-square-foot apartment where Teresa and Leonidae's bodies had been discovered. Neighbors told authorities that there had been whispers about the women and their husbands being unfaithful. Henry and Joseph worked odd jobs, but when neighbors were asked about these men, police heard the words shiftless and lazy and learned the men often spent money intended to support their families on alcohol. To make ends meet, Teresa and Leonidas took sewing jobs, but the financial stress took its toll on both of the marriages. Neighbors told police they often heard the couples fighting over money, and each had accused the other of cheating. Henry and Joseph Moiti were the two men New Orleans police wanted to talk to when the bodies were discovered. Joseph turned himself in to the police and claimed he had nothing to do with what happened in that apartment. He said he and Leonidas had separated earlier in the year after he discovered Leonidas had been sleeping with another man. Joseph took their children, left his wife, and moved in with his sister. He explained he didn't kill his wife and sister-in-law, but he knew who did, his brother. According to Joseph, Henry had murdered Leonidas and Teresa while the children were sleeping. Once he killed and dismembered the women, he cleaned himself up and changed his clothes. He then woke up his children and took them downstairs to a taxi. They arrived at his brother Joseph's house a little after 2 a.m., and Henry left his children with Joseph, explaining he had murdered Teresa and Leonidas, and he was there to leave his kids and say goodbye to all of them because he was headed to board a ship to escape New Orleans. There were seven vessels sailing out of the city on the day Joseph shared Henry's plan. Police radioed a request for all sailors to look out for a dark, bushy-haired man with very dark brown eyes and a distinctive tattoo on his arm, a nude woman with a flower in her hair. 2 days after the murders were discovered, two crew members spoke with a man who begged his way onto their ship using a false name. The men had read a newspaper account of the crime and noticed the man they were talking to had a tattoo matching the description from the newspaper. Henry Moiti was captured by these men and delivered to the Lafourche Parish Sheriff's Office. Henry Moiti confessed to the crime and implicated his brother Joseph as an accessory when he confirmed he had delivered his children to Joseph to ensure their safety and told his brother he had just murdered Teresa and Leonidas. Henry's motive for murder was driven by jealousy and paranoia, but he justified the murders, explaining his mind was controlled by alcohol, his jealousy over his wife's unfaithfulness, and he just wasn't able to control himself. Henry also told police he was convinced Teresa was having an affair with Joseph Caruso, the couple's landlord. Henry claimed Teresa neglected their children and told him she did plan to leave him. He also believed Leonidas was a negative influence on her sister and encouraged Teresa to leave Henry and their children. During questioning by New Orleans police, Henry was asked about a statement his housekeeper, Nettie, had made to them. Nettie told authorities that on the afternoon before the murders, Henry was upset and told her he would take a pistol and shoot both of those bastards. A few hours later, around 7 p.m., Nettie witnessed Leonidas, Henry, and Teresa, along with their children, leaving the apartment. They were laughing and joking around. But Henry paused and moved towards Nettie. He leaned down and whispered that if she heard children crying in the morning, she should remain calm and not be scared. She told police that statement came to mind the next morning when she opened the door and saw that pool of blood inside the apartment. Henry explained his skill with a cane knife he used to murder and dismember the women had been perfected during his time as a butcher's assistant. He had done the work in New Iberia, where he had met and fallen in love with Teresa, and continued the work in New Orleans. Henry was tried separately for the murder of Teresa and Leonidas. His lawyer called on a psychiatrist to try to prove Henry was mentally unstable and unable to tell right from wrong. They essentially argued the very nature of the crime and the public shock and disgust at learning how these women were murdered meant only a madman could have caused such a bloodbath. The prosecution argued Henry's motive was as old as time, pure jealousy, and he deserved to hang for what he had done. Now, public opinion about these murders seemed to shift during Henry Moody's trial, with some beginning to sympathize with Henry, as his wife and sister-in-law were blamed for acting in a way that led to their murders. Not loving their husbands enough seemed an understandable but not justifiable reason to murder women in the 1920s. Both juries found Henry Moody guilty, but sympathized with this man whose wife no longer loved him. They asked the court to grant Henry mercy. The judge agreed and sentenced Henry to life at Louisiana State Prison at Angola on July 6, 1928. Convict number 18038 was given a lot of freedom for a man imprisoned for premeditated murders. 6 years into his sentence, Henry Moody was recognized by guards as a trustee. This meant he was no longer under heavy guard, and he was given responsibilities, such as running errands. He was granted freedom of movement in prison and often left the area to help with a daily trip to the post office. Henry was able to escape in the summer of 1944. He claimed he had an errand to run at the post office, where he hired a taxi and asked to be driven to Hammond, Louisiana, where he caught a train to Chicago. Henry Moody remained on the run until 1946, when he was pulled over by police in St. Louis, Missouri. When questioned about his identity, Henry confessed he was that Henry Moody who would escape from a Louisiana prison. When Henry was returned to prison, his lawyer continued to petition the Louisiana Pardon Board for clemency, based on their argument that Henry had been temporarily insane at the time of the murders. On March 26, 1948, Louisiana Governor Jimmy Davis pardoned Henry Moody. That decision almost cost another woman her life. Henry Moody left Louisiana and headed to a place he felt he could start over again, California. In January 1956, Henry, along with his girlfriend Alberta Orange, checked into a hotel in Los Angeles. Soon after the couple went to their room, the phone rang at the front desk. The clerk answered and heard the gasping voice of a woman and eventually realized what the woman was saying. She had been shot. The clerk called for help and ran to the room where Alberta Orange had been shot in the chest. The bullet punctured a lung and things were touch and go for her, but she survived. When she was interviewed by police, Alberta said Henry shot her in the middle of a silly argument over whether or not he would give her money to buy clothes. Henry was arrested, tried, and convicted for attempted murder and assault with a gun. He was sentenced to 5 years at Folsom Prison, but his time at Folsom was short-lived. Henry Moody died of a stroke in December 1957. Now, some would say Henry Moody got away with murder. He served little time considering the disturbing and grisly manner in which he murdered Teresa and Leonidi. Joseph Moody escaped prosecution as an accessory to murder, but never expressed any sadness or shock about the murder of his wife, Leonidi. It seems Leonidi's story, discovered in her room, stained with her blood, was a foreshadowing of the end of two lives. She closed with these words, "I was happy for a time and became the mother of beautiful children, but the feeling of romance, of walking on clouds, and of seeing the world all pink and beautiful did not last long. Love left me." Southern Mysteries is created and hosted by me, Shannon Ballard. The New Orleans trunk murders share similarities with another crime on Ursuline Street, known as the Sausage Murder. In November 1927, the Times-Picayune reported a threat Henry Moody made from behind bars. Henry threatened Joseph Caruso, the man he was convinced Teresa was sleeping with, saying, "If I ever get my hands on that Caruso, I'll chop him up into little pieces. I'll make him look like something that's been run through a sausage mill." And we know Henry could have done that, considering he used his butcher skills to carry out the grisly murders of his wife and sister-in-law. The butcher had something in common with a French Quarter sausage maker. Back in the mid-19th century, German immigrants Mr. and Mrs. Hans Müller opened a sausage factory on the ground floor of their home at 725 Ursline Street, just a few doors down from the apartment where Henry killed Teresa and Leonidi. Legend says Hans Müller fell in love with another woman, so he made the decision Henry Moody made. Instead of leaving his wife, he killed her. Then he did the only thing he knew to do to prevent people from discovering the crime. He made sausages out of her body and served them to his customers in the butcher shop for weeks. But as the story goes, he was found out when a customer bit into a piece of Mrs. Mueller's wedding ring. Mrs. Müller was said to have had her vengeance. Legend says her ghost haunted the shop until Müller went insane and spent the rest of his life in an asylum. Is the story of Mr. and Mrs. Müller true? Absolutely not. Is it still told on ghost tours in the French Quarter? Of course it is. The story was originally published in a book printed in the late 1930s called Gumbo Yaya. It was a compilation of Louisiana crime stories. The folks who read the sausage ghost story were more than inclined to believe it and continued to share it from generation to generation. After all, it had only been a decade since folks in New Orleans had been reading headlines in the Times-Picayune about two very real and very horrific murders on Ursuline Street. If you are enjoying Southern Mysteries, I want to remind you this is an independent podcast, so anything you can do to help spread the word and share the love for the show would really help. There are several ways you can do that. You can rate and review the show where you're listening. That helps other people discover it and be willing to check it out. And also hit the follow button in your player so you never miss a new episode. Another free way to help the show is to share this episode or any of the episodes you're enjoying of Southern Mysteries. When you share it on your own platforms, it encourages your friends and family to check out Southern Mysteries, helps us grow, and that helps me continue to tell stories like the one you've heard today. Now, keep in mind, you can always find the sources for each episode in the full show notes at southernmysteries.com, and that is also where you can learn more about becoming a patron of Southern Mysteries. The show exists because of the core support from patrons who love these stories and want to hear more. Patreon is a platform that allows me to share bonus content and content you can't hear anywhere else. So if you want to learn more about supporting the show on Patreon and accessing episodes that are only available to patrons, you can check out patreon.com/southernmysteries. You can also find a link to the Patreon at southernmysteries.com. As always, thanks so much for listening.